podcast from the Refugee Study Centre. To find out more, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk.
Good evening. Thanks again for joining us in the seminar series, the next to last in this series devoted to the second phase of the Common European Asylum System. And tonight gives me a very special opportunity to thank my co-convener, Violeta Moreno-Lax, who will be our speaker tonight and who has done a great job in organizing and convening this series. So I'm glad that I have this opportunity of paying my respects. The fact that this seminar series has actually been able to attract the kind of speakers and the caliber of speakers that we've had so far and that we continue to have, I think says a lot about the credibility and the respect that Violeta has gained in the community. Violeta is a lecturer in law at the Law Faculty here in Oxford and at St. Hilda's College. She's also a visiting fellow at the Refugee Studies Center. I'm also proud to say that we come from the same alma mater, since Violeta is about to finish her doctoral studies and to defend her thesis in Louvain in Belgium on access to international protection. In the last 5 years or so, Violeta has written extensively on issues that are really very close to what we do here at the RSC, on migration studies, with of course a very strong legal focus on issues that go range from EU law stricto sensu to maritime law, human rights, and of course refugee law. She has published in the most prestigious law journals, and taking this opportunity to do a bit of propaganda, there is an edited book which is coming out in July on EU immigration and asylum law that Violeta is co-editing with Elspeth Gilt, who was here last week, and a few other big names in refugee law. Her topic tonight is very close to the subject of her thesis, but we are promised with a special twist, and it's called Accessing International Protection in Europe with a big question mark. Violeta, you have the floor.
So thanks a lot for being here today. Actually, the topic of my presentation is very much based on my doctoral research, and it relates to access to international protection in Europe. So it's like self-explanatory, the title. What I would like to do is actually to go through the background of the question, so how Europe has reacted to inflows of asylum seekers and refugees in the last decades, move to exploring what the main obligations and the main rights of refugees and asylum seekers under EU law and international law are, move then to explore the border control and migration management measures that have been put in place by the European Union and the member states to actually control access to international protection, I mean access to the territory of the Union and therefore to international protection in the Union. What I would like to see with you is how the measures have been put in practice, I mean put in law, and then how they have been operationalized in practice. So we're going to see what the general rules are, see whether there are any refugee exceptions for those rules, and then move to the operationalization of those rules on the ground. And then I hope we'll be in a good position to answer whether it is possible to reconcile EU policy with EU law. So without further delay, moving to the background. There is a lot of changing in my slide, and I hope this denotes the tension or the complex relationship that the Union has had with refugees and asylum seekers in the past. There's been a change in the composition of the flows directed to the European Union since the Refugee Convention was enacted. There's been a plethora of motives, motivating the those who come to search protection in the European Union. We've started talking about the asylum migration nexus and mixed migratory flows out of this. So the people who are coming now to Europe are very different from those who were coming during the 60s or 70s. Their motivations are mixed. And the flows themselves, I mean, the mixture is both within the refugees themselves and in the flow that they compose or to which they belong. There's been a change in the perceptions of refugees in Europe. Now we have started speaking about the bogus refugee. So the focus of the measures adopted by the European Union are actually on distilling the deserving from the non-deserving, so distinguishing those who actually deserve and are entitled to international protection from those who are just economic immigrants. There's been, I mean, all of this has been reflected in the approach that the European Union has adopted vis-a-vis refugees and migrants. There's been a continuous trend towards closure. So there's been a trend towards a restriction in the way in which access has been managed, starting in the 70s. We're going to see one by one what the measures that actually signify this closure are. We're going to see that there's been as well a changing framework. So these measures have been adopted under different paradigms. So when European integration started in the 50s, the main focus of the project was economic integration. Since then, we've gone a long way. Now the focus is a little bit more on political integration, on having a pseudo super federal state of the European Union. And this has some reflection in the way in which policies have been conceived of and in the way in which the measures have been tailored. Finally, we have a change in the numbers. If it is true that in the 80s, for instance, we reached a peak in asylum applications with many asylum seekers coming to Europe, that due to the fact that we had the Yugoslavian wars in the countries of ex-Yugoslavia and then the Kosovo outbreak during the 90s, one has to bear in mind that asylum application numbers have been in constant decline thereafter. So actually today, the number of asylum applications that the Union receives is actually very, very little. It's like 2% of the global number, if we would take into consideration the entire international community. So with all these changes in mind, I hope we can start off this adventure of exploring how access to international protection has been polished in Europe. The most important point that should come out of this slide is that there is a tension. So if Europe is preoccupied with the plight of refugees, is not so sympathetic to the plight of asylum seekers. So there's been some conceptualization of what an asylum seeker is, not only in policy, but now with the legal meaning. So an asylum seeker is actually someone who has asked for asylum, meaning has asked for recognition as a refugee. And that now, beside being a policy concept, has gained legal bearing. So this is now a legal concept under EU law. And there are consequences following from this, from this reconceptualization. One of the most important consequences is that until and unless somebody is recognized as a refugee, he or she is still an asylum seeker. And it means that he or she integrates the migrant mass directed towards Europe. And that migrant mass is the one that the Union is trying to regulate. And what is striking is that unless the people integrating that mass have been authorized to come to Europe, they're going to be treated as irregular migrants. So it means that in the journey that the refugee has to undergo since the, I mean, from the country of origin until arrival at the external frontiers of the European Union, he or she is first going to be categorized as an irregular migrant, and then if recognized at the end of the journey as a refugee, then treated according to the Geneva Convention on the Rights of Refugees. So this legalization of the concept of asylum seeker is actually very, very important. It seems to be anecdotal, but it's actually pivotal in the way in which the whole policy and the administration of inflows of refugees towards the Union has been designed. So a refugee is a refugee, but recognition has been delayed until the person reaches the territory of the Union where he or she can enter the recognition procedure. And before that point, the person is not treated as a refugee, is treated as an asylum seeker, which normally doesn't have any means to legally come to the Union, and therefore is going to be treated as an irregular immigrant, all right? So from this dichotomy, it should become clearer the tension underpinning both the aim that the Union is pursuing and the means through which this aim is being pursued. The aim is to facilitate legal access to the European Union, according to the Stockholm Programme, adopted in December 2009. The Union adopts every 5 years programs that are those which are given the policy direction, the political direction, to the adoption of legal measures to administer asylum and immigration policy. So before the Stockholm program, we had two other programs, which I might be mentioning today. One was the Hague program, adopted in 2004, December. And the first and the father of all programs was the Tampere program, adopted in 1999, with which the Common European Asylum System was formulated for the first time as being an objective of the Union. So we are in our third programmatic set of principles which come out of the Stockholm program. The aim continues to be the same as it was formulated in 1999. We want to facilitate legal access on the one hand, and we want to counteract illegal immigration on the other hand. This seems to be clear-cut and very, you know, straightforward. We don't want illegal entries. We only want controlled and authorized entries into the Union. The means that the Union has given itself to actually reach both aims are three. The first is a border policy, the second is a common immigration policy, and the third is an asylum policy. The border policy requires that the Union introduces something called the integrated border management system, which we're going to see in a second, is a set of rules that tries to manage the inflow of people coming to Europe throughout the entire journey that they have to undertake from the country of origin up to the external frontiers of the European Union. All right, the immigration policy comes in support of the border policy, and what the Union purports to achieve is a common immigration policy aimed at ensuring at all stages the efficient management of migration flows. So at all stages, meaning since the migrant leaves the country of origin up to the external frontiers of the European Union. With regard to asylum policy, the focus is quite different. What we want is to provide protection here. So already from the way in which the relationship between the aims and the means that the Union has given itself to achieve the overall goal of facilitating legal entry and preventing illegal entry, we can see that there is already an imbalance. Whereas on the control side of things, we want to control the journey of the refugee and the journey of the immigrant from the very point in which the person starts the voyage. Protection is only to be provided here, once the territory of the Union has been reached. So there is a vacuum in between. There is absolutely no protection for the person in transit towards the European Union. I hope that little by little this is going to become progressively clearer and clearer. There are a number of principles underpinning this relationship between aims and means. And they denote this tension between the pronounced objective of facilitating legal entry and the other objective, the that requires the fight against irregular immigration. So these four principles are taken both from the European Union treaties themselves and from the programmatic documents that the Union has been progressively adopting throughout the years. So from the treaty itself, it becomes apparent that the Union is supposed to constitute what it has been called the area of freedom, security and justice, and that this construction has to be in respect for fundamental rights, generically. Now, this area, according to the Tampere conclusions, so the first pentennial program, which was given the political direction to be adopted in the adoption of the different measures of the immigration, border, and asylum policies of the European Union, according to this first program of 1999, the area must remain accessible to those whose circumstances lead them justifiably to seek access to our territory. So, to refugees, right? All right, so this would be one of the first principles. We want an area that respects fundamental rights, these including the rights of refugees. We want that this area, that is composed of all the different territories of the member states of the European Union, remains accessible to refugees. But on the other hand, we want that irregular migrants are kept out of this integrated territory, of this area of freedom, security and justice. So the tension is captured by the European Pact on Immigration and Asylum, adopted in 2008, where the heads of states and governments of the European Union member states say that the strengthening of border controls must not prevent access to protection. So we already know that actually what we're doing may have an impact on actual practical access to protection in the European Union. Recently, in a series of measures that were adopted in 2011 for the reinforcement of the protection of the external borders of the European Union, the heads of states and government reinstated that border controls must respect human rights, the rights of people in need of international protection, and the principle of non-refoulement. So the policymaker is actually aware of the fact that there is a tension. So if we want to regulate legal access and prevent illegal access, the measures are directed in principle to the same people. So unless there are measures within those wider policies that allow us for a distinction to be made between the deserving and the non-deserving, everybody's going to be caught up in the fight against irregular immigration, right? This is one of the risks. So let's see whether the rights of the deserving, the rights of the refugees, have been actually be taken into account in the design of those general measures for the administration of migratory flows. The model that has been adopted for integrated border management, so for the management of both the external frontiers of the Union and the management of migratory flows directed towards the European Union, has been called the four-tier access control model. So there are four things, four stages, four groups of measures that the European Union is adopting and putting in place so that access is controlled from the very beginning, so from the point in which the migrant starts his journey up to the external frontiers of the member states. The first are a bunch of measures that are adopted and implemented abroad. And I have chosen one among the many, visas. We're going to see what visas do to refugees and asylum seekers in a second. At the second level, so from those measures which are implemented directly inside the country of origin of the person, there are a series of measures which are adopted while the person is in transit and are implemented right at that point, in transit. And these measures may be adopted in cooperation with, may be implemented in cooperation with the states or with the participation of private actors. There are two examples here of measures that would intervene when the person is in transit. We have immigration liaison officers posted abroad. Everybody's quite familiar with the case of the Prague airport of the House of Lords, 2005. We're not going to be analyzing this. I'm going to be focusing on career sanctions, which are those measures which actually rely on private carrier companies to actually implement visa controls before the person actually meets the real border guard at the external frontiers of the Union. Then we have surveillance at the very external frontiers of the EU. This is operationalized through Frontex. Frontex is the external frontiers agency of the Union, who is actually in charge of coordinating the action undertaken by the several member states at the external frontiers of the Union. And one of the things that Frontex does is to coordinate joint maritime patrols. So there's been a number of operations happening since 2005 up to today, directed and coordinated by Frontex, which are characterized by interdiction of those which are supposed not to be authorized to enter the European Union. Finally, there are controls which take place inside the territory of the Union. And those are something that we're not going to be looking at today. There are something called thorough checks and spot checks. These are legal terms defined under EU law. But as I said, I'm not going to be focusing on this, because these controls happen already when the person has arrived in the European Union member states. At the end of the chain of controls, I've added a fifth level, which is the one that occurs when it is made clear that the person is not a refugee and is not entitled otherwise to international protection. What happens then is that there will be an expulsion order, and through the standards adopted under the Return Directive and via readmission agreements that the European Union member states and the European Union itself has signed with third countries, the person which is not a refugee and is otherwise not entitled to stay is going to be removed out of the territory. So this is like the corollary of this 40-year access control model. Like, the end result, if somebody is not authorized to stay, is going to be expelled. All right, so we're going to be concentrating on the three first the three first levels. So the measures which are implemented inside the country of origin, those which are implemented while the person is in transit, and those which are implemented at the very borders of the member states. So moving on, I just have another slide to signify once more the tension between this dual aim that the Union is pursuing of facilitating legal entry on the one hand and combating illegal immigration on the other hand. The flows are mixed, as we know. They are composed of many different types of people. These types have a legal categorization in the law. These different types of persons have different entitlements under international law, but also under the law of the Union. We're talking about refugees, asylum seekers, other persons in need of international protection, which could comprise victims of trafficking, for instance, which could comprise unaccompanied minors. Then we have economic migrants, if this category actually exists in purity. I don't know if there are any pure economic migrants out there trying to reach irregularly the Union with pure and clean motives, and those being economic opportunity, but it might be the case. And then we have the generic category of irregular entrants, so people which are smuggled, and we don't ask them why. So there are rules to fight against smuggling, which actually tend to disregard the motives underlying those who have been smuggled. Surprise, surprise, what happens is that all these categories of people employ the same means of transport to get to the Union. They have recourse to the same smugglers and traffickers. They use the same false documents to reach the European Union. They use the same routes, and they aspire to get to the same countries of destination. So although legally or conceptually, we could actually draw the lines very clearly. These are refugees, these are non-refugees. Refugees get protection, the others do not. As if this would be actually so easy. The thing is that while in transit, while the person is coming to the European Union, the migrant mass is kind of quite undifferentiated because of this, because they employ the same means of transport, the same smugglers, the same false documents, the same routes, and they aspire to reach the same countries of destination. So these are all practical issues that render the legal differentiation or the conceptual differentiation quite difficult in practice. Okay, so moving to my second point, we've left the background. We now have like enough information on the tension underlying the reaction of the European Union towards mixed flows and towards inflows of people in general. There are several rights with corresponding obligations binding upon the member states of the European Union and the European Union, allegedly the European Union itself, which benefit a number of people, not only refugees, but generally, normally, anybody and everybody. There is a right to leave any country, including one's own. There is a right to seek and obtain asylum from persecution. There is a right to life with an obligation of protection arising out of that particular entitlement. We have a right to protection from refoulement, protection from torture, protection from arbitrary detention and imprisonment. We have a right to a fair trial, and we have a right to an effective remedy if, whenever we enter a particular legal procedure, the outcome is negative, we are not happy with it. In theory, there has to be a second opportunity for the person to reinstate his or her rights. So these are all rights which benefit several categories of people, of those which were mentioned, not only refugees, but we're going to see that under European law, we are going to introduce a new category, the third country nationals category. All of these rights have been actually operationalized or integrated in EU law within the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. So in this slide, you have the correspondence between the different rights and the articles in the particular instrument in which these rights have been introduced and now belong as part of European Union law. So if we consider that the rights and obligations are quite clear, let's move for a second to the legal decomposition of these different rights. The Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union has a scope of application which is arguably larger than any other human rights system or any other set of rules that we could think of in international law, which would protect refugees and other migrants in transit. The Charter of Fundamental Rights applies to everyone. At some points, for instance, with regard to the right to asylum, it only applies to foreigners, something that we called under EU law third country nationals. So there is protection beyond the Refugee Convention for people who might not qualify as refugees. So in theory, not only refugees, but many of those who integrate mixed flows are entitled to protection under the European Union Charter of Fundamental Rights. The material scope of application, so the substance of those rights, is also larger than in any other system of human rights protection. Why that? Because the Charter actually accumulates standards. It takes from international human rights law and from international refugee law and amalgamates those standards, brings them together into one consolidated EU law standard. So it means that beyond the protection that refugees could get under the Refugee Convention or the generic protection that anybody could get under human rights law instruments, EU law provides everything at the same time, I mean, to put it very simply. And this is because the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights main objective is to reaffirm the rights that exist out there in other systems, which are binding on the member states of the Union. All right, the most important point is the territorial scope of application of the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. And this is where the whole difference could be made. According to Article 51 of this charter, the charter applies to both the Union and the member states whenever EU law is relevant. So whenever they are acting within the realm of EU law, for instance, implementing visa policy or implementing Frontex maritime patrols, EU law is relevant and the charter should be observed. So this means that the divide between territoriality and extraterritoriality, which has been very much discussed in refugee law circles and within international human rights law, under the Charter of Fundamental Rights appears to be irrelevant. Whenever EU law applies, the Charter applies, and it doesn't matter whether that is within or without the boundaries, the territorial boundaries of the EU member states. Okay, I'm really trying to simplify. I mean, you may imagine that all of what I'm saying is not uncontested. But so for the sake of the argument, bear with me. So just what I presented, this functional approach to the scope of application in territorial terms of EU charter rights, is not so crystal clear. There is a part of the doctrine that says that rights do not apply extraterritorially. However, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that if EU law, in the sense of EU visas, apply abroad, the EU label sticks to it, the fundamental rights side of EU law. So whenever you do an EU law thing, wherever it happens, you bring EU law with you. So you cannot leave the rights at home and the control, I mean, take the control wherever you want. So that's conceptually the premise, is that power brings obligations and responsibility. You cannot just implement raw power, because, I mean, it's a notion that doesn't exist under international law either. All right, so moving on, let's go measure by measure. I have four, so try to bear with me. I think I have four more, I mean, some more 10 minutes. So I would like to revise four measures of extraterritorial control. The first is the framework measure, the Schengen Borders Code. Is the code that the Union gave to itself governing the entire border policy. The general rule, according to this border code, is that entrants need valid travel documents to come here, and they need to prove that they have means, economic means, for their stay in the Union, and they have to show willingness to return to the country from where they come. Otherwise, entry has to be refused, all right? So, summarizing, there is no entry without documents and without showing willingness to return, all right? And this has been regulated in the code itself. The code contemplates what I have called a refugee exception. So there is a special regime, at least incipiently, that regulates or that caters for refugees. There are a bunch of articles, there are two that I have on my slide, Article 5.4 and 13.2 in the code, saying that notwithstanding the general rule, entry may exceptionally be authorized on account of international obligations. The code doesn't go so far as to make explicit what type of international obligations we are speaking about, but one should think that because they belong to the family of international obligations, human rights and refugee law obligations should be implicitly comprised by the notion of international obligation. All right, then, if this is so, there is an exception on the rules to refuse entry. The court says that entry shall be without prejudice to the application of special provisions concerning the right of asylum and the right to international protection. Now, what the problem is that those special provisions have not been made explicit anywhere. There is just a handbook which was prepared by a political actor, the European Commission, with a number of good practices or non-legally binding standards that were put together to guide border guards in their implementation, in their practical application of the code. But as such, there is nowhere to be found this notion of special provisions. I mean, we do not really know what it means. We don't know if border guards have to channel asylum applications to the particularly competent body under national law. We don't really know if border guards have to ask people actively if they want to seek protection. So we don't really know. We know that there is an exception or the possibility of an exception, but we do not know exactly how that exception should be operationalized in practice, let alone whether it is obligatory to go through that exception in the case of refugees. So this is the panorama under the Schengen Borders Code. There are three more measures that I would like to go through with you. Visas is the first. So visas are this pre-border authorization to travel to the European Union member states. There is a common Schengen visa policy that has been put together since the 90s and throughout the 2000s. There are two main legal instruments that were adopted to this effect: Regulation 539 of 2001 and something called the Community Code on Visas. Together, they actually constitute like the main body regulating visa policy under EU law. So whenever you hear about Schengen visas, what we're talking about are these rules. So the rules under which you gain access, I mean, you, a third country national, a foreigner, subject to the visa requirement, gains access to the Schengen territory. So the general rule is that you need visas to travel only if your country is listed in the common visa list. There are 135 states listed. So all Arab countries, all countries with black population, all non-Christian states are on those lists, including, therefore, all refugee-producing countries. So if you would think about, I don't know, Afghanistan, Somalia, which are the two countries which are at the top of those producing refugees in the European Union, those are in the list, quite high actually. Visas are only issued under the common rules if the person meets the Schengen Borders Code criteria. So it means that the person has to have travel documents, means of subsistence, and has to show willingness to return to the point in which the visa was issued or somewhere else outside the Union after, I mean, before the expiry of the visa. So the rationale is that if you don't get pre-entry authorization, you're not supposed to travel to the Union because you're not going to get entry permission, okay? Again, there is a pseudo-refugee exception in this scheme. The visa policy, in theory, is supposed to respect fundamental rights and observe the principles recognized in the Charter, so the Charter that we just spoke about. And this has something a bit more concrete to it. In the Community Code on Visas, if a member state considers it necessary to derogate from the entry criteria in the Schengen Borders Code due to international obligations, presumably including refugee law obligations, a limited territorial validity visa may be issued, meaning that the state can grant permission to access its own territory, not permission to access the combined territory of all the Schengen member states, but just under, you know, its own sovereignty and its own responsibility, the state is authorized to grant access to its single territory. All right, so that's what there is for refugees. Now, how is this operationalized? Again, the clause of the refugee exception is phrased under may terms. So it's something like I mean, it sounds as something that states can do, but they're not obliged to do, legally speaking. And there is no block of harmonized rules which would explain how this should happen in practice. Like, I mean, who starts? Is the refugee who has to kind of know that there exists a possibility for a limited territorial validity visa to be applied for? Or is it the consular staff which has to proactively inform the person that in case of a fear of persecution or something like that, this is an available possibility that is open to him or her? So there is nothing of the such. There is no harmonized rules explaining how these refugee exceptions should work in practice. And there is a further problem which is not dealt with in law, which is the problem of physical access to embassies. There are countries in the world which are listed under the blacklist of the visa regulation. So countries whose nationals need visas to come to us, but there are no representations, there are no embassies there. One such example is Somalia. So Somalia is on the blacklist, but there are no EU member states embassies in Somalia. So Somalis, even if they would like to, they do not have access to the visa procedure, all right? So again, you may imagine this is problematic. If we go to Korea sanctions, Korea sanctions are a measure which were introduced in the 90s in different member states across the Union to enlist private transport companies as deputy sheriffs or as deputy border guards. So there are people, I mean, the idea was that Koreans would willingly enforce visa regulations before the person would start traveling towards the territory of the member states to avoid a refusal of entry, because that, if it would happen, would entail for the carrier a penalization, so a fine, all right? So money to be paid for such, if something like that would happen. So there are sanctions to carriers if they transport undocumented migrants, and this is so because what we want is to combat illegal immigration. So through the measure of carrier sanctions, what we do is to bring in private actors as enforcers of the law. And the whole advantage of this for the member states is that the law is enforced even before the person reaches his destination, okay? So there are an amount of resources that do not need to be mobilized because the person would be stopped in transit before he or she would reach the border, so before the asylum procedure could be entered, and therefore before any procedural or any reception resources would be mobilized for this person. So in practice, what happens is that if you do not have documents, if you don't have visas, there's going to be a refusal of boarding, all right? So the carrier will not allow you in, will not allow you to take the plane or the boat, and therefore you will be prevented from traveling. Again, these regulations, which have been codified in something called the Convention Implementing the Schengen Agreement, and then the Directive of 51 of 2001, these general rules have, again, integrated some sort of refugee exception. So the regulations say that all this system, all these carrier sanctions mechanisms should work subject to the obligations resulting from accession to the Refugee Convention, or else without prejudice to member states' obligations in the case in which a third country national seeks international protection. Beautiful, but then again, how is this operationalized in practice? We don't know. There is nothing in the rules. There is no procedure, no remedies, no operationalization in practice of this refugee exception. All right, my last measure, interdiction at sea, as carried out and coordinated, carried out by the member states, coordinated by the Frontex agency. So the scheme, again, in three times is more or less the same as for the other measures. We have a general rule. You are going to be interdicted if you do not have the requisite documents for authorized entry. So unauthorized arrivals are stopped before they can get entry at the external frontiers of the member states. Why is this? Well, first of all, because the mission of Frontex is actually to facilitate and improve integrated border management. Integrated border management, on the other hand, is supposed to help this combat against illegal immigration that the Union has initiated. And one of the things that Frontex is authorized or called on to do to actually combat irregular immigration is to coordinate joint patrolling operations at sea. Okay, so different member states will come together at the external frontiers of the Union, and under the direction of Frontex, they're going to be patrolling a particular area, stopping people, interdicting them, and checking whether they are authorized to continue their voyage. If they are not, normally they are returned to the third country of embarkation, so the third country from where they took the boat that is currently being interdicted. There is a refugee exception, again. Here, the refugee exception is even more explicit than in any other of the rules that we have just explored. In the Frontex regulations, it is said that the tasks of Frontex must be performed, among other things, in compliance with obligations related to access to international protection. So more explicit than that, I don't think it can get. And there is more. One of the articles of the Frontex regulation explicitly mentions the obligation of non-refoulement, so that nobody shall be disembarked or handed over to the authorities of other country if that would contravene non-refoulement obligations. So if that handing over or return or disembarkation in a third country would amount to the exposure of the person to torture, persecution, or human rights violations, that's forbidden under the Frontex regulation. So in theory, Frontex should be taking care of that, that the joint patrolling of the waters, according to the joint action of the member states, doesn't lead to the refoulement of people, okay? Again, the operationalization of this is nowhere to be found. We don't know exactly which types of procedures or remedies or other measures should actually be adopted so that this, which is stated in the law, actually happens in practice, all right? We do not know exactly what happens in practice because there's no independent monitoring. So we do not know what is happening at sea, as we do not know what happens in international airports, as we do not know what happens in embassies. All right, so the law says something, but then the statistics say something else. The available statistics, we don't have statistics as regards visa refusals. We don't know there are statistics making explicit the number of visa refusals in member states' embassies, but there is no breakdown of the figures. We don't know who was saying that they were refugees. We have the overall numbers, but we don't know which of that corresponds to refugees. The same applies to carrier sanctions. And for Frontex, we do not have statistics, but there's been press reports and reports by international organizations and NGOs making explicit that actually thousands have been returned or even prevented from leaving the country that they were trying to escape. So we know that some of those who were caught in transit through these measures were probably in need of international protection. All right, if this is so, and with this I finish my presentation, two questions. Is the Union doing what it says it is doing? And if you would remember, in theory, legal access had to be facilitated, whereas unauthorized access had to be fought against. And in this scheme, the overall purpose of the Union was to provide protection to those deserving and to refuse entry to those undeserving. That was the policy question. the legal question, if we agree that whenever EU law applies or is applied, even if that happens abroad, the fundamental rights side of that EU law accompanies the exercise of power, then is the EU doing what it must be doing, what it should be doing? If the answer is no, and I suspect you will agree with me that it might actually be in the negative, what is the way forward? And there are two possibilities. Either pre-border measures adjust and integrate, you know, fundamental rights really into their operationalization. I mean, really, in practice, the refugee exception is made possible. Or if this is not possible, then, legally speaking, there is a hierarchy. Fundamental rights are at the top. The exercise of power through extraterritorial controls has to submit to that is at the top, the rights. So rights cannot be sacrificed for exercises of control. So it means that the measures which will not be possibly adjusted to the respect for fundamental rights will need to be abandoned, all right? And with this, I close it. Thank you very much for your attention.
For more information about the different ways you can stay updated and engaged with the work of the Refugee Study Centre, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk/resources/connect.